Now. Good evening, folks.
This meeting is being recorded.
Good evening, folks, and welcome to the first episode of our new name, Myth Behaving. It's still the same old podcast, still the same old posts, and still the same old tired jokes, but we have a new name.
We do.
How you doing tonight, Rob?
I'm doing good. How you doing, Kari?
I'm well, thank you. I'm excited about our April guest.
Oh my goodness. Are you ready to hear about our guest?
I am. Who do we have for our first show as Myth Behaving, Rob?
I am honored to introduce you to John Gray. John is a New York-based writer, director, producer. He created the long-running hit CBS series Ghost Whisperer, starring Jennifer Love Hewitt, as well as writing and directing many award-winning and critically acclaimed movies for television, such as Martin and Lewis, starring Sean Hayes and Jeremy Northam, the Emmy-nominated A Place for Annie with Sissy Spacek, the Emmy-nominated miniseries Haven with Natasha Richardson and Anne Bancroft, Helter Skelter with Bruno Kirby, and many others. He has directed dozens of episodes of series across the broadcast and cable spectrum and was also the producing director of the CBS series Reckless. He has written and directed several studio and independent feature films, including the award-winning White Irish Drinkers, starring Stephen Lang and Karen Allen, which premiered at the Toronto Film Festival. His acclaimed short films have played and are playing in film festivals all over the world, including the Cannes Short Film Festival. His short film, French Kiss, has notched, get this, 6.3 million views to date on YouTube. Wow. Kari, John Gray.
Hi, Kari.
Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you. I'm exhausted just from hearing all this.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
I was going to say, we can do all his, like, we could list all his accolades, but it's going to take the entire show. Like, we're just going to be like, okay, that's it for tonight.
I'm feeling like I have, you just haven't done much with your life, John. Do you feel
I'm a slacker. I'm a slacker.
Just hanging out. You did a few things, and you're like, yeah, that's good.
And I'm only 28. That's the amazing thing.
I want to touch really quickly on something. I'm going to try not to focus the whole time on Ghost Whisperer, but I'm a massive Ghost Whisperer fan. And I was just telling Rob before you signed on that I have a debt of gratitude towards you because I used to watch a show when it first came out. So the first couple seasons, and I always loved how attentive Jim Gordon was to Melinda. And I actually chose my own partner based on that quality that I loved about Jim. I remember thinking to myself, I am never going to settle down until I find a man that is that into me, that supportive. I am not a ghost psychic, but I need that kind of support. And so thank you. Thank you for creating this man who just, you know, was so. Now, are you that good of a husband?
I doubt it. Inspired to, but we'll have to ask my wife, but
we'll have to have her on the show. So now you've done all this screenwriting and all this directing, and now you've taken your first, is this your first novel that's just coming out?
Well, it's the fourth one I've written, but it's the first one that I felt was ready for prime time and actually, you know, made an attempt to get published.
Okay.
What about this novel made you feel like that? Because I know what you're talking about. Like, I have novels that are still sitting at the bottom of a trunk and haven't seen the light of day yet. But I'm just curious what you're like. This is the one. This one, I'm ready for people to read.
Yeah, I think I learned a lot from the other novels I wrote, you know, particularly what not to do. And my wife is also... she's just a brilliant novelist herself. And she gave me some just tremendous advice and I learned a lot from her. And when I took on this latest novel, I really decided that I did not want to concentrate on, this will sound weird, but I didn't want to, you know, concentrate on making a work of art. You know, I wanted to write something that was commercial, that people would want to read, and, you know, that I might have a chance to sell. And so, you know, I came up with kind of this supernatural thriller, you know, genre, which is a genre I love and I'm very at home in. And, you know, I love to read those kinds of novels. And, I felt like for my first serious attempt at getting a novel out there, I wanted to try something a little bit edgier and that had some commercial value. Hopefully, we'll see.
So tell us about your novel.
Well, as I say, it's a supernatural thriller. It's set in a morgue in New York City. And it basically revolves around this young woman, Jennifer Shelby, whose life is kind of at a crossroads. She's only 20 years old. Her father just recently died. And she had been in pre-med in college, wanting to be a doctor. But when her father died, she discovered that there was no money, that he was just hanging on by his thumbnails to try to pay her tuition. And with him gone, there's no more tuition, so she has to leave school. And she was very close to her dad. He was a single parent. And the circumstances of his death were very sad and difficult. And so she is lost, and she ends up, through an old professor of hers, getting a job at the New York City morgue as a night attendant, basically working the night shift. And she works by herself, and her job is to basically do a lot of paperwork and catch up with things that the day shift doesn't have time to do. But also she pulls bodies for autopsies in the morning, and she'll check in bodies, do intake when bodies come in, who are found dead during the night, or many of them are murder victims. Some of them are just people who died of natural causes, accident victims. She sees it all, and she really is comfortable in this kind of environment because it's quiet. No one's there except the dead. And she doesn't mind being around the dead. And she's just trying to figure out her next move and kind of doing this job in order to do that. But the reality is she hasn't really done much figuring out. She's just kind of floating. She's kind of depressed. And then into her life comes this very charismatic, bad boy English movie star named Trevor Price. And Trevor has been sentenced to community service at the morgue for his latest DUI. And so he starts working the night shift with her at the morgue, and they don't get along well at all. And Trevor is just this fun-loving, completely substance abusing guy who doesn't really care about anything except having fun in the moment. And so they kind of clash, but together they discover that the morgue is haunted. Mm. And Jennifer comes to believe that his disrespect for the dead and his general sort of hijinks in the morgue have unleashed this curse, that a centuries-old curse that has to be sort of solved by both of them. They have to kind of team up and solve this curse. That might be a longer explanation than you were looking for, but
it's absolutely spine.
And it's actually based on a kind of a real thing. Back, I think it was, it might have been 2015, I think. Lindsay Lohan was sentenced to community service at the LA County Morgue.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think for a DUI. And she did 53 days at the morgue as an attendant. I don't think she worked nights. But when I read about that, that kind of got me thinking about, how interesting would that be
if
in the world of this morgue comes a movie star?
Yeah.
So that's sort of what was the genesis of it.
I like it. I love it. I love it.
I can't wait to read it. But, I can't wait
there's
to
a... So that's kind of it's not always a running theme, but that's kind of a theme of yours, right? You kind of have a theme with the other world and supernatural. Is that just something you love to explore?
It is. As a kid, I really loved horror, particularly gothic horror. I was never a big fan of, slasher horror or torture porn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I really liked, the old fashioned haunted house movie.
Haunted houses, yeah. Me too. Me too. I used to do a paranormal podcast.
Oh, really?
Where we interviewed people that had lived in haunted houses. So I actually interviewed Laura DiDio, who was the news reporter that was with George and Kathleen Lutz from the Amityville Horror House. And she was in the horror house with Ed and Lorraine Warren. you must know who they are if you're a fan.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, I got to interview Laura, and she told me about being in the house during what she called was the psychic sleepover. I interviewed Andrea Perrin, who they made a movie called The Conjuring about her family that lived in a house in Rhode Island.
Yeah, yeah.
So me too, which is why I watch Ghost Whisperer, of course. Your show. But yeah, so I mean, so I get it. So you believe in ghosts. Have you ever had any ghost encounters?
Well, you know, we did. My wife and I had just moved into a new house just at the time I was shooting a pilot of Ghost Whisperer. Mm-hmm. And even leading up to that, we had been having some kind of weird things, noises and things like that in the house. And you know, we'd be sleeping at night and we would hear sounds from the attic above us as if people were moving furniture around. And, you know, it's a tiny attic. There's no room up there for furniture, and it shouldn't be being moved around in the middle of the night. But there were. And so, you know, we just didn't quite know what to do. And we could hear footsteps on the staircase leading up to the second floor where we slept. And, you know, we both just kind of thought, this must be just, you know, it's a new house. We're not used to it. There's all these kind of, maybe there's squirrels or something in the you know, attic. And one morning I was getting my daughter ready for school. And I was making her breakfast, and she had these cardboard jigsaw puzzle pieces. And on one side, there's little squares, there were probably about two dozen of them. Mm-hmm. And on one side of these little squares, it was a design that fit together and was the puzzle. And the other side was just blank cardboard. So one morning when she was having breakfast, she had put the puzzle together. And so the design side was up. And I took her plates away, put them in the kitchen sink, came back to the table, and now the entire puzzle was upside down. Mm. And I know she didn't do it. And
no.
You know, I kind of looked at this, and you know, and it's funny how you just went to this denial. It's like, no, it can't be. Just this, it yeah. can't be. It can't be
something. Yeah. You always look for the rationale. You always look for the rationale.
So I go off to LA to shoot the pilot. My wife is going to join me eventually, but she's staying in New York for a couple of weeks. And I'm in a hotel in the city of Orange in LA while we're shooting. And she calls me one night and says, you know, things are really bad here in the house. The lights are going on and off. I'm hearing all these weird noises. And she's calling me from a hotel. She left the house. And what really tore it for her was that the doorbell kept ringing.
Oh, jeez.
And at the middle of the night. And, you know, now there was no one there. So eventually she got just fed up with it. She cut the wire to, you know, from the bell to the actual bell. And it rang again.
Yeah, of course. Because it would.
Yeah. Oh, so she went.
That is so scary.
Oh, yeah. So she went to a hotel that night. And then the next day she came out to L.A. and we finished the pilot out there. And so when we got back to New York, I thought to myself, well, you know, I'm doing this show called Ghost Whisperer, and there's this woman named Mary Ann who was the person that the show is based on. And so I called and I said, look, I think we're having this experience. Would you come to our house and check it out? And she did, God bless her. She lives in Cleveland. She flew to to New York, and we put her up in a hotel nearby. And you know, her gift is that, like Melinda in Ghost Whisperer, she can see ghosts who haven't crossed over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there was no drama about it. There was no mysticism. She just kind of sat there at her kitchen table and said, yep, there are two ghosts here. There's a mother and a son here. They don't like you. They like the previous owners better.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's just mean.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm not crazy.
You know us first.
Yeah. And she got them to cross over. And it was amazing because when she said they were gone, we literally could feel a lightning. You know, the house felt less
heavy. The house felt different. Yeah.
The air felt lighter. Different. Yeah. It was really you know, pretty amazing.
So a lot of people say that.
Yeah. That was my only real, you know, kind of up close and personal experience with the supernatural.
That's pretty intense, John.
Yeah, most people right? Why? Where's that movie?
Right. No, it'll show up somewhere.
Yeah. So it wasn't.
When I first met with Mary Ann, In LA, we went to the Starbucks, and I was just fascinated with her and the fact that she was just this kind of down to earth Midwestern woman, and her husband was with her, and he's this also salt of the earth guy with tattoos and a crew cut, you know, mm-hmm. ex-military, mm-hmm. not the people you normally would expect are, you know, supernaturally inclined people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I asked her, I said, so Marianne, do you just constantly see dead people? Is it just like everywhere? And she said, yeah. She said, yeah. I mean, everywhere I go, she said, there's three in the Starbucks right now.
Mm.
And, you know, she explained to me who they were. And, you know, that became one of the first scenes in the pilot.
Yeah.
Where they're sitting in the coffee shop and right. explaining, you know, the three the people. So,
yeah.
It's great fun.
No, that's a fun, it's a fun show. That Ghost Whisperer is like kind of heavy in parts, but still the premise is kind of fun and like not light, but interesting to play with. I enjoyed a lot of the stories that you were telling in there. So.
Good. Well, and the hair and the outfits too.
But yeah. Now, it's so 90s.
I loved her, Jennifer Love Hewitt's hair and outfits. In that
show. She's wonderful.
And the smoky eyeshadow was amazing. And she was amazing mm-hmm. in that mm-hmm. show.
Yeah.
How did you first hear about Marianne, John?
Well, I had a long, long term relationship with CBS.
Mm-hmm.
I've done many, many movies for them. And at the time, I was not really, you know, I wasn't interested in series that much. I was having this fantastic career doing movies, and I love that. And but the executive who I work with all the time at CBS had a problem in her home with ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
And someone told her about Marianne, and Marianne came and apparently rid her house of ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman called me and said, you know, really, you got to meet Marianne. I just think it might be a series here. I'm like, no, I don't know if I want to do a series really. Well, look, just meet with her and, you know. And then I had that meeting at Starbucks. And I thought, I remember driving away from that meeting and thinking, you know, I love horror. And I love character-driven drama, emotional drama.
Yeah.
So here's a way to combine them and try to make a little horror movie every week that has an undertone of emotion about death and, you know, redemption and closure and guilt, all the things that surround death.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just got really excited. And I just thought, great, I'm going to do this. You know, I've never written a pilot. I'll try, I'm sure it'll go nowhere. I'll try it. So I wrote the pilot. And the next thing I know, I get a call saying, okay, we're going to make the pilot. I thought, oh, well, okay. Well, I've never directed a pilot. So this will be fun. And I'm sure it'll go nowhere. And I'll just go back to my movie life after the pilot's over. And then, you know, when the pilot was over, they said, okay, we're going to do 13. And I was like, oh, no, I got to do this 13 more times. How can I?
No, don't force this on me.
Right. And then, you know, after 13, okay, we're going to give you 9 more to fill out the first season. And then, you know, we went for 5 seasons, and it was just a lot of fun. It was a good, you know, we had a great time shooting that show, and, it was like a family. It was really, really good.
But familiar to me, some movies that are familiar to me. I'm curious. I want to bring one up, but I don't. Maybe we'll get to it organically. I'm curious if there are any favorites of yours that you wish people would watch. Like if there's like a diamond in the rough that you're like, man, this movie people should have watched.
Well, you know, it's really hard to pick a favorite because I'm often asked, like, what's your favorite movie?
Right.
And, you know, the truth is that when I watch a film I've made, which I don't do that often, but sometimes I do, the emotional feeling I have has to do with the experience of making the movie.
Right.
I remember being on that location and working with those people mm-hmm. and where I lived and the experiences that I had. And, you know, whenever I would make a movie, I'd be 4 or 5 months in some other place and really get immersed in how people live in that city and wherever it was. So it's hard for me to separate that when I think about what are my favorite films. You know, whether the films are good or bad, it's really about the making of them that I remember and gives me joy. You know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I suppose, I think, you know, I made a movie about the relationship between Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis.
Mm.
Called Martin Lewis.
Right.
And I really I love making that film. It was a fantastic cast, Sean Hayes and Jeremy
Northam. Sean Hayes, yeah.
Wonderful. And I really fought for Jeremy Northam because I just felt he could really embody Dean Martin. And the network didn't see it, and we had a big, you know, kind of fight over it, but we ultimately got him. He was my first choice. And Sean Hayes was already attached to the project when I got to it, so, you know, which was fantastic. Mm-hmm. But it just, you know, I like the movie a lot because of the amount of time it covers. It's a showbiz kind of, you know, film, and it's kind of a love story between these two guys. Mm-hmm. You know, I think kind of heartbreaking and sad and difficult. And so that's just one that I, you know, and I did very well when it aired. But it never came out on you know, DVD or now streaming, because I think there was a dispute over the Dean Martin music that was in the movie.
Oh.
And they were able to make a deal for the music for the broadcast for the on ABC, but they could never come to terms on a deal for ancillary markets.
Oh.
So it's just kind of, you know, it's just kind of dead. You know, it's a shame. It's, you know, that no one can get to see it, even if just for the performances. You know,
right. Right.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Short-lived. Yeah. What are some of your favorite movies that you didn't make?
None. Only mine.
Only yours. I'm not plugging anybody else here, lady. No. Wait, way.
There are other movies besides the ones I make?
There, no, not that I've heard of.
I haven't seen any.
Right.
Well, you know, I love classics. You know, I really, I was steeped in the classics growing up. And, you know, Citizen Kane and Casablanca and all the mm-hmm. Warner Brothers movies of the 40s. And I was very, very lucky when I was in my early 20s. And it was before, this is how old I am, it was before... well, certainly before streaming and digital, but even before, you know, VCRs became, you know, popular. And in New York, there were two retro movie theaters. One was called the Carnegie Hall Cinema, and the other was called the Bleecker Street Cinema.
Mm.
And these two movies basically, you know, played older films and classics, hard to find movies. Again, because, you know, you couldn't just turn on Amazon Prime and find some old movie. So there was a summer in which both Bleecker Street and Carnegie Hall played movies from the golden age of Hollywood, you know, from mm-hmm. the 30s and the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew most of the films already by reputation and saw many of them on TV, broadcast TV, all chopped up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent that entire summer. I would literally see six movies a weekend,
mm.
you know, three double features, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and just be immersed in the way my parents saw those movies on a big screen, mm-hmm. with a crowded theater. And I would just, to this day, I remember walking out of those theaters on a hot summer night and just feeling like I was walking on air, just feeling like,
yeah,
mm-hmm. I got to do this. You know, this is like the greatest thing ever. I was transported during those 4 hours of watching those two movies, and, you know, I laughed and I cried and I got, you know, the whole thing. I get so emotionally involved in films, and it really, you know, that's what I want to try to give to people. That's what I want. I want someone to walk out of a movie I made with that same feeling. You know, that's always mm-hmm. what kind of inspired me.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just wrapping up. I mean, that's really my background really is in those classics.
So I'm curious with the shift, especially where COVID pushed us out of movie theaters and that kind of thing. And I used to love going to movie theaters. Same thing. I would have to sit through the credits to kind of process what I had seen and the emotional story that I'd just gone on.
What do you mean used to?
I don't go to theaters anymore because mostly COVID and you know, now, and because of COVID, I really got set up in my house with a decent, you know, really nice TV and streaming and everything. And I'm curious, John, do you think movies can still have that same emotional impact if you're sitting on your couch rather than sitting in a dark movie theater with people in that giant screen?
No.
Okay.
No, I agree. I think there's
something about it. Yeah.
It really is.
Well, it's that collective
yeah,
sort of euphoria you get when you're sitting in a movie and something funny happens and everybody laughs. It's like something that brings us together.
Well, and I also think that because the movie shows at this time and it's not going to pause for you to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And there's no break in the emotional storytelling. And so a good movie that gets you, you're like, you got to make those choices, right? Yeah. Like, am I going to stay for the ride or am I going to give up this scene? And and because you're there for the whole time and you have to be there, then you have to be invested for the whole time where kids come running out and you want more potato chips and, you know, the dog just jumped in your lap and kicked the salsa off. Like, it breaks the emotional flow of the movie.
So you obviously know what's going on in my house.
I didn't want to break it to you like this, John.
That's not creepy at all, Rob.
No, no. And I'm also very much alive. So,
No, it is. It's a loss. It's really a loss. And, you know, I feel so grateful to be the age I am and having straddled the analog and digital era, so that I grew up, you know, going to the movies on the weekends and and being with you know, big crowd and standing on line to go into a movie. You know, I love that. And you know, and listen, I love digital technology. I've embraced it. I'm grateful for that too. But I just I look at my daughter and I just think, man, she'll never really have that experience the way we had it.
Right.
I guess every generation feels the way about the prior generation. And I think where we're going, and I'm sad about it, but I mean, and listen, let me preface this by saying, you know, people have been writing the obituary for movies for forever. You know, it's like Broadway, you know, it's dead and it never dies. And I hope that it doesn't die and it comes back stronger than ever. But my fear is that where we're heading with theatrical movies is that they're going to become the place of the, you know, tentpole, gigantic franchise, you know, Marvel movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And the emotional, you know, the Neil Simon comedies and the emotional Peter Weir movies, you know, they're going to play on Netflix, Amazon, and, you know, Apple. And and that's just, I just think that's where it's going. You know, I just think that people, you know, people are not going to leave their houses to go see an emotional movie about a relationship, you know.
Right.
But they might very well see it, you know, on your television.
Yeah. Like Marriage Story, everybody watched it in their comfy chairs and kind of glanced sidelong at your spouse, like, is this us?
Yes.
But yeah, absolutely.
Which is a loss.
It is. It's terrible. It really is. And people don't really know what they're missing. But I think that it's a trend in our society now towards being isolated. Mm. And I think that, you know, obviously the pandemic just really moved that along in a big way. But I think that we're more and more becoming society that, you know, we get things delivered to us. We want, we stream movies, we stream television shows. You know, we're not really interacting anymore. Everything is contactless. And, you know, we're just kind of online banking. I mean, everything is being designed, I feel, to keep us apart. And I think that's awful.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, I think part of the problem with people making movies today is that everything has to be on this massive scale. Like you mentioned, Neil Simon, he wrote Brighton Beach Memoirs, didn't he? Isn't that one of his?
Yeah.
Yeah. One of my favorite movies. They actually, I never saw the play, but I saw the movie with the one she plays Blanche, the mother, I can't remember. Gwyneth Paltrow's mom. I can't remember her name. I can't remember her name. Lovely woman with a lovely voice. And that's one of my favorite
films. Dan.
Yes, yes. And that's one of my favorite films because it's hilarious. It shows life, you know, as a young Jewish boy in a New York neighborhood. I think it's the 1930s or 40s.
Yeah.
A time that I didn't live in.
Yeah.
And so it sort of gives you an insight into that little slice of American pie.
Yeah.
And I think that the problem with these massive Marvel movies, you know, there's like 17 or 20 of them, is that they're sort of taking away that sort of just casual look into just a tiny little vignette of like just a normal life, mm-hmm. which I yeah. think is hugely lacking of when kids weren't in front of electronics and when kids, you know, didn't have, like you said, everything speedily delivered to them. And I think that's part of the problem is because you can't make a movie like that now because nobody's going to go see it because it people's attention spans aren't even the same.
Yes. And that's a great point you make because, you know, a lot of the inspiration I had as a kid to want to tell stories and make movies is because I could sit in a movie theater and I could see characters on a screen experience an emotion or go through something that I yes. felt like, ah, I'm not alone.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Someone else has felt this, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not often that I sit and think, you know, wow, my spidey sense is tingling. And,
you know, right? Like, I don't pick up my, I'm not a billionaire that created a suit that allows yeah. me to fly. Like, I can't, right. I can't.
And those cool. are fun movies. I like those movies. I go see those movies.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
No, it shouldn't be
they're
the fun. Only movies that you have.
Exactly. They're fun to watch. But I sort of miss even like just the silly teenage movies of my era, like 16 Candles and Breakfast right. Club and Teenagers Struggling and people having, you know, I miss that. And yeah. it doesn't yeah. seem like anybody's making those movies anymore. So I really hope that changes.
I do too.
Well, maybe it will now that we're supposedly we're exiting the pandemic. So that's good. And that frees up some of these film makers to explore more and in ways that they couldn't during the pandemic. So,
yeah,
so maybe we'll see some more, but yeah.
John, one question. So for your book, and I don't think we've said the title of your new book that's coming out. What's the title?
It's called The Desecrated.
Yep.
The Desecrated. Okay. So now being a filmmaker, say your book gets made into a film. Did you base your even just the look or sound or movement of your two protagonists, Jennifer Shelby and Trevor Price? Did you base them on anybody famous? And if you were to turn that into a movie, who would you cast to play those characters?
You know, yeah, I haven't given that much thought. You know, I whenever I write a character, I never, because it's just happening with my scripts too all the time. But yeah. I was never able to assign, you know, them to a movie star or a well-known actor. Somehow, I just can't do it that way when I'm in the process of writing it. You know, because they're so specific in my head, and I see them as who I, you know, think they are and who I'm trying to make them into. So whenever I try to tailor it or think about a movie star or an actor, you know, I find that it starts to become something that's external rather than internal.
Right.
And
right.
so it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't really work. I will say though, that I do think both of these roles are very castable. They're, because this is besides it being a supernatural thriller, it is very mm-hmm. character driven.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the characters will all have arcs. And there's a whole crew of very quirky and funny and dangerous and just oddball supporting characters that are in and around this morgue. It's a fun read, I think, for that reason. And someday we'll make a fun movie for that reason as well.
Mm-hmm.
When is the book coming out?
We are aiming for the summer. We're hoping July.
And I think that's partly, Rob, you're partly responsible for that.
Only tangentially. I'm not.
Okay.
So John is with Elysium Press, and that's my
right.
press, but I'm like the junior okay. partner on that list. So this one is definitely being handled by Mare, who is a very seasoned editor and working closely
right,
with
right.
John.
Okay.
To get that managed, and if she's saying summer, then I would suspect it will be summer. She's pretty she's pretty hard driven like that.
Mary, if it's good air, it's in good hands. If it's in her hands,
yeah.
Now tell us about your writing process, John. How did you tell us about sitting down to write this book?
Well, you know, I tend to be very disciplined about writing. And it's only because I'm really not that disciplined about writing. So I have to really impose a very strict schedule. Because if I deviate from that schedule, then I just go off the rails and it doesn't, I just can't make it work. But I write every day, and I basically write, I try to get to work about 8:30 or so in the morning, and I go till about noon. And then, I just take care of whatever daily stuff has to be done. I exercise, have some food, run errands. And then I try to come back and do another 2 hours or so at night, like from 7 to 9. And if I'm on a huge role, I'm doing great. Or if I've got a deadline, like on a script or something, then I'll try to grab a couple of hours in the afternoon as well. But usually that's the model that worked for me. And I do that 7 days a week, except on Saturdays and Sundays, and I don't do the morning session, but I just do the evening session.
Do you reward yourself? Like if you've made your session that day or that week, do you like, okay, Snickers it is, or...
I don't really, I mean, I feel good about it. And, I have to keep telling myself oftentimes, because I tend to want to measure writing by how many pages I get done. And I have to keep telling myself, sometimes you can sit there for 2.5 hours thinking.
Yeah.
And it's just as much writing as it is pounding the keyboard. Right. But I often, if I spent 2.5 hours thinking about something, I often walk away feeling, oh, crap. It wasn't a really productive session. But of course it is. So, I love writing, but like anybody who writes knows, it's difficult and it can be lonely, and only you can really help yourself out of the morass when you fall to a place that you're trying to get out of. But I love it. And I do try to be very disciplined about it. And, the pandemic was really my motivation to write the novel. I've been thinking about doing this for a long time. And when the pandemic hit, I just thought, this is it. This is my chance. I'm just going to use this time to write this damn novel.
Nice. No, I love
and
it.
What kind of a writer are you? Did you do an outline? Do you do chapter outlines, or are you just what do they call those? Rob, pantsers?
Pantsers.
Pants. Like, do you just write?
Are you a plotter or a pantser? Fly by your pants.
Pants. Oh, I never even heard that. Already from this podcast. It's amazing. I do an outline. I sort of follow the same template I use for my scripts. And that is, I don't do chapter outlines, but I did an outline of the story, basically where I see it going, how it begins, how it ends for sure, and some major milestones along the way. And then I just kind of started writing. I feel like, and I got this from script writing, there's a point at which I feel I've outlined enough. Mm-hmm. It's not everything is tied up and ready to go, but I know enough that, I feel like I have a good foundation. And so there's just that weird place where I just have to feel it by instinct that I know I'm ready. And that's how I got with the novel, where I'd done some character bios and I laid out the plot, and I just, there were still things I didn't know yet, but I thought that's okay. It's time to start writing, and I'll discover these things as I go. I guess that's the key for me, is a leading room for discovery. Because I'm sure, Rob, you know this, and there comes a point where you're in the sweet spot when it starts writing itself, but it's almost like the characters start to do things on their own, mm-hmm. and they resist things that you had planned in the outline.
Right. Right.
And you suddenly realize this isn't working.
Yep.
And this character doesn't want to do this.
Yep.
You gotta pay attention to this.
Or this character wouldn't do it because they develop too,
Yeah. It's right. Like exactly.
Watching
right.
somebody grow up.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just me personally, not that anybody cares what I do, but when I'm working, I always have a separate file, a Word file that I just call stuff. And when a scene doesn't work and I determine it doesn't work, even though it's written, I'm not going to delete that thing because I certainly put effort into it. I just cut it, drop it into the stuff folder. And I found that I end up with a file almost as long as my book, which maybe that tells you something about my, I'm a pantser, but apparently my process. and every now and then, I'm like, oh my gosh, I've written that scene. That's going to, that if I just tweak it here and slide it back over here, it, and so I love saving that stuff, but sometimes that stuff still sits there to this day, all dusty, and will never see the light of day. So
yeah, it's great to have that. It's just, it's really great. I mean, I do a similar thing, and whenever I sit down to write something new, the first thing I do is go through that file.
Right.
And just, you know, oh yeah, there was that, you know, well, that scene sucks, but that this character might be really interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a great thing to do. I think you're smart to do it.
Yeah. And that you have those lines that you're like, it's not working here. But if you go back to it, you're like, oh, that line that goes with this other character. I've got it. Oh yeah, there it is. Don't kill your darlings. Just set them aside to see if they grow.
Stuff them into a folder called
a folder. Stuff. Ignore them for a while.
Well, I can just imagine
both of you have fabulous stories. So I can imagine that your stuff folders are equally as interesting. But that's and on that note, that's kind of all the time we have for today, guys.
Sadly, all the time we'll have today. But John, it was so great to speak with you. Can we have you back when the book comes out?
Yeah,
please. Yeah, I love that.
Okay, all right.
Oh, I'd love to have you back, and I want to read the book first, and then we'll have you back so I can rave about
that's
that.
That's exactly what we'll do. Yeah,
great.
And thank you so much for coming on the show, and folks, your book is called The Desecrated,
yes,
by John Gray, and it will be out in the summer, and we of course will share that on our podcast page. And until next time, we are now Myth Behaving with Kari and Rob. Remember, so we've changed our name. Check your Facebook page, check your Twitter, you'll see the changes there. Thank you so much for coming on the show, John. It was such a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all the time for today, folks. See you next time. Good night.
Good night, Kari.